And it's time to bring up our speaker for the evening, Jim.
Thank you, Nick. Hi, everybody. My name is Jim, and yes, I am definitely an Al-Anon. So, this is a pretty special month for me. This is my birthday month, February. I'll be 12 years old this month, and I would have taken my cake at your lovely meeting, but I take a cake at my home meeting in Simi Valley, which is where I hail from. Tuesday, if any of you are in that area on a Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. So 12 years ago, I came to my first Al-Anon meeting in Simi Valley, that same Tuesday meeting. And I know it was the last Tuesday of the month because they had cake. And I like cake. I figured that was my higher power doing for me what I could not do for myself. I said to myself, these people have cake. Like, this is great. So I think I'll come back. Only the next time they didn't have cake. But, you know, they did have lots of smiles and hugs. And at that time, that's really what I needed. Because my life was a wreck. And I was in complete despair. I was married to an alcoholic at the time, and we were raising 4 daughters. But I'll get to more of that later. So, show of hands, does anybody here love an alcoholic? Good, good. You're in the right place, just like me. And you know, that is the source of my disease. My illness is trying to love an alcoholic, trying to love at many junctures the unlovable. And you know, the insanity of that was just more than I could take. So I have a joke that I like to tell about Al-Anons. So two Al-Anons are walking down the beach and a seagull flies over. The seagull drops what seagulls do. And the one looks at the other and says, oh, that's really gross. Can I get you some tissue? He says, nah, don't bother. He's probably miles away by now. Because that's what I did, you know. The alcoholic would crap all over me and I'd say, oh, honey, that's terrible. Can I wipe that for you? It is really what I consider it's a special kind of hell on earth to try and love an alcoholic. And some of you have probably heard the expression that religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell, and spirituality is for people who've already been there. So Al-Anon is where I got my spirituality, truly. There was no spirituality in my life at that point. I really never had any. And that stems from my upbringing. So I'm going to basically tell my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So I grew up here in the Valley. I was born in Van Nuys, lived in Panorama City, and was surrounded by drinkers. Now, some of them were probably alcoholics. A lot of them were probably just drunks. And you know, the difference between an alcoholic and a drunk is the alcoholics go to meetings, right? Some of them were just what I've heard called normies. We was people that just drink, and you know, maybe they drink too much sometimes, but most of the time they're under control. So yeah, at that time, that was I was born in 61, so that was during the 60s and 70s, which there was a lot of drinking and drugging going on in that era. And I was surrounded by it. So I got used to the idea, I think, that you know, this is just how life works. People drink, people do drugs, and it's just what goes on. I do know that my Al-Anonism started long before I was born, because my mom was a perfect Al-Anon. She still is today. She's never been to a meeting, and she'll probably never go. She'll be 79 this year. And I still have both my parents, so I'm very, very grateful for that. But my mom was raised by an alcoholic. I never met the man, but I understand he was a pretty seriously bad drunk. He was a rageaholic and very, very cruel. One of the stories that I heard, you know, kind of in hushed tones when I was young is when his children would get in trouble, my mom and my uncle, his punishment would be to put a circle on the wall so that they had to stand on their tippy toes and put their nose in the circle. And if their heels hit the ground, they got a whipping. So, you know, I was never treated that way. And at the time, I didn't understand the cruelty of that. But, you know, over the years, it sunk in. My grandmother, who was married to that man, he died, by the way, of this disease, some sort of pancreatic illness, which everyone said was due to the fact that he chewed on his fingernails. I kind of doubt it, but you know, these are the stories we get told. So my grandmother, my mother's mother, married another alcoholic, my step-grandfather, Joe, and he was a serious drinker. It was amazing how much that guy could drink. A whole bottle of, you know, Chivas Regal in one day. That was pretty typical for him. But again, he's another one that essentially drank himself to death. He died in his 80s, early 80s, but he died of basically scarring of the esophagus. And it was so severe that he couldn't eat. So essentially he starved to death as a result of his drinking. My mother's brother, Joe, my Uncle Joe was a lot of fun growing up. We had a lot of good times together. But, you know, later he turned into a coke addict. And I didn't find out till I was in my teen years, but he was actually dealing coke and doing, obviously, a lot of coke. Again, his disease killed him. He died of a heart attack, is of course the story that the family likes to tell. But, you know, the part they leave out, yeah, well, he died of a heart attack while he was busy and high on coke. So, you know, okay, you know, it's their story, not mine. Then there was my sister, which I am one of two children. My sister was 5 years older than me, and I didn't find out till much later, my later teen, early 20 years, that she had been a drug addict using drugs basically from the age of 13. And she started by taking her lunch money and going to school so that she could buy pills, whether they were Reds or Whites or whatever they were selling in those days. And her life became just one tragedy after another. She ended up leaving home when she was 16 and moving in with a biker, drug addict, alcoholic who lived up here in the Tujunga area. Maybe you guys are familiar with the Tujunga area. It was not pretty in those days. There was a lot of bikers up there. And, you know, she loved an alcoholic biker. Big surprise. So, you know, growing up, my sister and I were really not very close due to the five-year age difference. But she managed to torture me quite a bit. You know, she was quite a bit bigger than me. So one of her favorite tricks was to hold me down and tickle me with her hair. Okay, you know, I always swore I'd get her back for it, but you know, I really never did. Although my dad used to tell her constantly, you know, someday he's going to be bigger than you. Someday. And of course I was. But by that time, you know, I had developed a pretty good relationship with her, so she escaped the wrath of Jim. But you know, her disease just progressed and progressed, got worse. She was married, divorced, had a daughter, my niece, who now is a very, very fine young lady up in Idaho. And my sister eventually ended up with a guy who was an intravenous drug user. And I don't know exactly what they were shooting up at the time, but she ended up with AIDS. And that was after she had already had kidney failure as a result of her drug use. But the AIDS was pretty much the last straw for her. And in 1988, she took her own life, which at the time, she was 32. I was 27 and just starting my life with my alcoholic, which I will get to. But kind of as a preview of my life with the alcoholic, in there was my first girlfriend, Debbie, whose mom was an alcoholic. Go figure. And Debbie was the first love of my life, but her mom, oh my God, she was a serious, serious alcoholic. You know, she would be slurring, falling down drunk by 3 in the afternoon, every day. And you know, at that time, I didn't know what it was. You know, it was just, here's a person that drinks a lot, and it just didn't click for me. You know, that this was a disease and then it was going to progress and that people are going to die from it. I had no idea. So what happened? I ended up marrying Deborah, my first wife, which, by the way, I am also married again to this lovely lady here, Jen, just last year. One of the finer days in my life. So anyway, Deborah, wow. You know, she was kind of everything that I had never been or wanted. Growing up, I was a very studious kid. I was identified as gifted at a very young age, and they put me in special classes and said, you're going to do great things, and you need to learn these things, and on and on and on. I just wanted to be a kid. I really had no idea what this was about. But anyway, I did get seriously into my studies, because when I was studying and doing the work, you know, everything else was just out of the equation. I was focused on learning and doing well in school, and I did very well in school. Ended up going to UCLA, ended up getting a degree in physics from UCLA, and in my last quarter at UCLA, I met Deborah. And I met Deborah, of course, in a bar at Weber's. I don't know if any of you know it. It's over on... it's over on Van Owen, just past Tampa. My best friend at the time, also an alcoholic, was the doorman. So I went there one night to see him. You know, I walk in, I look across the room, our eyes meet, and I knew she needed me. I stole that line, by the way. But it's true, because she was everything that I had never really known. You know, as I said, my mom's a perfect Al-Anon. She's very quiet, very reserved. You know, there was very little drama going on in the house, ever. And Deborah was just a party animal. Woohoo! Let's have a good time! And I said, great! Me too! Let's do it! So we had a good time. And I did quite a bit of partying with her myself. I didn't know it at the time, but her parents were both serious alcoholics. Her mother was one who would drink every day until she was drunk, passed out on the couch by 3 p.m. You know, no connection in my head here with anything from my past. So anyway, she had a little girl who was 14 months old, and I was just graduating college. I went, wow. She's kind of a single mom. Her ex-boyfriend at the time was a coke dealer. Hey, what do you know? He was dealing coke out of a catering truck that he drove around to a lot of the businesses in the Van Nuys area. And I don't know how the hell he got away with that, but he did for a long time. So, Deborah and I get married. You know, of course, I love the little girl. She's still, you know, I won't say she's my favorite daughter, but she's the daughter that I have the best relationship with today, still. And she goes to Channel Islands, and she's a wonderful young lady. But not shortly after being together with Deborah, she got pregnant, and I wasn't too sure about that. You know, I was just getting started in my career as an engineer. I wasn't too sure. You know, we had one daughter. I wasn't sure I was really ready for another one, but we said, okay, you know, we're going to have another daughter. That incident or that occurrence produced a rift between me and my sister. She was still alive at the time. And she was very adamant that I not get involved with this woman and that I not have this baby with this woman. And that yielded basically a 2-year rift in our relationship, which wasn't healed until right before, actually a few weeks before she ended up taking her own life. First daughter, Candace, was born in 1987. God, that was amazing. You know, I love my daughters. And having a child, watching the birth, I was there for the birth, was amazing to me. So, you know, we were living at the time over in Panorama City near Roscoe and... Sepulveda, and things went pretty well for a while, quite a while. For the first about 18 months, then Candace developed a little lump on the side of her nose. We didn't know what it was. Took her to the doctor. Doctor says, we don't know what that is, but we want you to go down to Children's Hospital right now. I said, okay. So we did, took our 18-month-old little girl down to Children's Hospital, where they put us on the sixth floor, which, if you don't know, is the oncology ward for Children's Hospital, where all of the little kids that have cancer are being treated. That is a place, my God. There's no description for what goes on when you end up, when you find yourself in a place like that. So Candace ended up having a series of three surgeries to remove this thing, which turned out to be a benign tumor called a myxoma, very rare, but it was not cancerous. So it was not going to spread. It was not going to kill her. It was just very, very disfiguring at the time. And that just ripped, you know, that ripped my heart out. And Deborah, and her drinking, of course, that was her answer to pain in our lives. It was drink. And she drank a lot. I just really got involved in my work. You know, I kind of focused on my work. I went to work, and life went on. I'll come back to Candace, though. Candace is 26 now. So 5 years after Candace, we have Chelsea, my third daughter. Chelsea was a great little kid, beautiful, vivacious, smart, and still is to this day. She ended up with her own troubles recently with, she got married to a guy who turned out to be an addict and an alcoholic, and very shortly thereafter, they got divorced. That was just a short time ago. After Chelsea came Stephanie. Stephanie was another big challenge for us. She was born in 94. And Stephanie was born with a genetic disorder called phenylketonuria. It's a genetic disease of the liver. And essentially, your liver is incapable of metabolizing phenylalanine. Now, phenylalanine is a constituent of nearly all the proteins that you eat, whether it's meat, fish, dairy, even vegetable proteins. So she was immediately put on a very strict, special formula that had no phenylalanine, but provided her most of the other nutrients that she needed. Well, the stuff was horrid. It tasted bad, it smelled bad. And she was a 2-week-old baby, and she did not want to drink it. Big surprise, you know, she's going from mother's milk to this stuff. So Deborah, you know, she said, well, she won't drink it. You know, I'm not going to do this. And that precipitated some really horrible, horrible fights. Because the doctors were telling us, look, if you don't feed her this stuff, she's going to end up institutionalized. This stuff, you know, you cannot feed her a normal diet. She will end up with severe permanent brain damage. I'm going, great, show me the stuff. You know, she's going to drink it. That's it, you know. But Deborah was not having it. And of course, in typical alcoholic fashion, she turned to the alcohol and drank large, large amounts of alcohol. So that was some serious fights. You know, those are the kind of fights where we're screaming at each other at the top of our lungs, you know, eventually calling the police, and the police coming and trying to break it up, and, you know, can't you guys just get along? And I, well, she's a baby. Can you fucking believe what she's doing? Blah, blah. Calm down, Mr. Steele. It's okay. You know. Well, it really wasn't okay, because the drinking, right, you know, as many of you know, the alcoholism progresses, and I think These may have been precipitating incidents for her. It may just be part of her genetics. I don't know. But her drinking went out of control after that. She started going to a lot of bars. You know, she'd be out till all hours of the night, and I'd be calling around trying to find her. This is before cell phones. So we did it the old-fashioned way. Right? You call the bar. Is Deborah there? Oh, I'll look. See. Drive over there. I'm loading four little kids in the car. Let's go find your mom. Yes, really, really, really bad. And, sometimes I'd get a hold of her. I'd say, look, are you going to come home? The girls are going to go to bed. They're asking for you. They want you to give them a kiss. Yeah, I'll be home. I'll be home in a minute. Okay. An hour goes by. Are you going to come home? Oh, I'll be home in a minute. Yeah. 3 in the morning. She's still not home. And one day it got really just too much for me. She was out at the bar. She came home drunk about 3 in the morning. And I was ready. I was waiting for her. This time, I had the suitcase. She was going to pack it. And she was going to leave. That was my plan. Didn't work out that way. She came home, poured herself a drink, of course, and proceeded to drink it. And I explained to her that she was leaving. And she explained to me that no, she wasn't. And I bodily removed her from the house. Basically shoved her out the front door, slammed the door and locked it. She, fortunately for me, did not call the police on this occasion because I probably would have ended up in jail on that night. I come to find out later that's what they call assault. It's like, what do you mean? She's a drunk. I was throwing her out. That's what I'm supposed to do, isn't it? Apparently not. So after that, we began, obviously our marriage was in serious trouble. She was out of the house, by the way, for about 3 or 4 days. Took the kids with her. We eventually reconciled kind of on the grounds that we would go to marriage therapy and, we're going to try and work this out, right? All right. So we get a marriage counselor, start going to see this marriage counselor. And one day, the first session with the marriage counselor, they always want to know, so why are you here? Well, I want to, we're having problems in this divorce. In this marriage, I want to try and work it out. She says, I want a divorce. And the marriage therapist is like, okay, which is it going to be here? Which way are we going with this? And I insisted that we were going to try and work it out. And she insisted that, no, we were getting divorced. And we kind of left it that way, I think, at the first session. Came back for another session. By that time, I had kind of convinced her that we needed to try and work this out. So she agreed. And we did a couple of marriage therapy sessions. Then, one day I come to the counselor's office and we're waiting and Deborah's late because she's always late. She shows up and she's drunk. And I looked at her and I'm like, really? Really? It's, 3 in the afternoon. And by this time, the counselor had kind of figured out that we had a drinking problem in our relationship. So she was sitting there. She was, okay, so what do you guys, all right, what are we going to talk about today? And I was like, I don't know. You ask her. She's drunk. She looks at her. Have you been drinking, Deborah? Well, yeah. So what's it to you? She says, well, we really can't do a lot while you're under the influence. This, I didn't know at the time, but this was my first experience with detachment. So the counselor basically said, you guys got to leave because I'm not doing this with you. So we did, and she was so pissed off that was it. There are no going to be no more marriage therapy there. All right, well, on we go. So, some more time goes on. Finally, convince her again that we need to go back to marriage therapy. We get another counselor, and this time we Yeah, she's, I think at this time, somewhere in there, she had decided that maybe she did have a drinking problem. And she actually went to AA. She actually came home one time and told me, you know, I think I'm an alcoholic. No, really? What a shock to me. But it wasn't too long after that that she decided, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to drink. All right. Good luck with that. So anyway, we ended up back in counseling again and went to regular sessions for about a year. I remember one very telling day when, you know, the counselor looked at me and she says, Jim, you're just like shut down here. And I said, yeah, I am. Because I was, by that point, completely worn down, completely shut down. You know, I had feelings were not something that were safe for me to feel. I didn't know, every time I came home from work, I didn't know what kind of a minefield I was walking into. You know, it could be her and her, one of her drinking buddies. It could be Happy Deborah, who's, oh, glad you're home. There was no certainty there. So I did the only thing that I, at the time, I knew how to do. I was just pretty much shut down. So that was right around 2000. And if you guys remember, in 2000, we had something called the dot-com bubble burst. And I was an engineering manager out in Camarillo working for a company that had been growing like mad. We were doing great. You know, our sales were doubling every year. Next thing you know, sales went from, you know, basically dropped to about 20% of their previous levels. And we went from 120 people down to 40 people in a matter of 6 to 8 months. And it was just really ugly. And on top of that, my dad calls and says he's got a heart condition. Well, between everything that was going on at home and all of this stuff, I was completely fried. So I had a complete meltdown myself. And I ended up in hospitalized for about 3 days. So what they, you know, clinically they call it major depression. In industry they call it a meltdown. I was just sick and tired. I was burnt, done. That was it. The good news is that was kind of my bottom. From that point, I figured out real quick, okay, there is something seriously wrong in my life. This is no way to live. I am not going to be able to live a life like this. I need to do something about this. So I ended up in therapy with a counselor. Ooh, I'm into the last third of my talk. So that was kind of what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. Well, after that, I got together with this counselor and started seeing him regularly. And he explained to me that, Jim, you know, you've been clinically depressed. You know, you need to get on medication. You need to do all these things. I'm like, okay, you tell me how to fix it. I'm there. I'm a fixer. You know, you give me I'm an engineer. I'm trying to fix this alcoholic. And, all right, you telling me what I need to do to fix me? All right, I'm good. Let's go. So, you know, I get on medication and start seeing him regularly. Things start improving. And then gradually he says, you know, Jim, have you ever thought about going to Al-Anon? I'm like, Al-Anon? What's that? Well, you know, it's for people that love an alcoholic. It's where they go to, you know, learn how to deal with these things. I'm like, nah, I don't want to do that. I don't need to go someplace where people are going to tell me about what the, you know, the horror stories of what their drunk is doing. You know, I got that at home. I don't need to hear more stories like that. Well, you know, that was because I didn't know what this program was about. But eventually, he convinced me. So I went to my first meeting, where they had cake. So, all right, George, dude, you should have told me they had cake. But anyway, you know, I went to that first meeting, and I sat there, and I remember, and I just cried. Because, you know, my marriage was a wreck. I was a wreck. My kids, I didn't even know what my kids were doing at that point. You know, they were little girls, and I was so busy with doing the dance with the alcoholic that, you know, I missed a lot of their early years, and I do regret that today. But, you know, I did the best I could at the time. And, you know, today I have great relationships with my children, for the most part. The one daughter that I mentioned that was in the hospital with the surgeries, Candace, she turned out to be an addict. Yeah, can you believe it? She got involved with, first it was pills, and then eventually it progressed to heroin. And she was an OxyContin user. That got to the point where, well, I'll come back to that. So I'll go back to the first meeting. Because fortunately for me, when she got to that point, I had already been in program some time. I had some of this stuff under my belt. So my early years in program, like I said, my first meeting was February of 2001. And I think for about the first 4 years, I was a very slow learner. You know, the first thing I learned about was detachment. Oh, you mean I don't have to argue with the alcoholic? Really? But how can I get her to stop drinking if I don't, you know, I got to engage and tell her what she's doing wrong here, right? And they just kind of smiled and said, keep coming back, you know. Okay. You know, I kind of figured early on, too, that somehow, you know, these people, you guys must have some kind of, they're all happy. I'm like, well, what did you guys, how did you do that? You know, did you get your alcoholic to stop drinking? How did you do that? You got to tell me how to do that. They wouldn't tell me. I guess I have to come back more. And, you know, maybe the secret, maybe they don't tell you the secret till you've been here a while. I don't know. So I'll keep coming back. So I did. And then they talked about detaching with love. No, that wasn't working for me. You know, when the alcoholic was drinking, it was detachment with extreme prejudice. at best. And, you know, I frequently vacillated between the point where I loved her so much I wanted to kill her. And I've shared many times in meetings today, to this day, she does not know how lucky she is to be alive. Really. There's the only reason she is because I knew I'd get caught. You know, I know they'd catch me. I'd be the first one they suspect. Jim, where were you on the night? So, anyway, going on these, both the first, you know, I learned about step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. No. Because I know how alcohol affects me. You know, I can have a couple of beers. I can have a drink. And I'm done. I'm not powerless over that. What do you mean I'm powerless over alcohol? And then I figured out, oh, what they mean is I'm powerless over her drinking. Oh, okay. That makes sense. And, you know, that our lives had become unmanageable. Yeah, my life was a wreck. So clearly it was unmanageable. Then I learned about step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I thought, well, I guess I am. I guess implicit in that, restore us to sanity means I must be insane. Well, I think any rational person looking at my life would say, dude, you're pretty messed up. So, okay, I could own that. And then step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. That was tough for me. Because at first, I didn't really have a higher power. And to turn my will over to something that I really didn't believe in, no, that wasn't happening. And, you know, I was reading the steps, and I would read step 12 that said, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I doubt it. But, okay, that's step 12, right? There's 11 more that I get to go through before I get there. But turns out, you know, step three today is one of the most powerful steps for me, because today I do have a higher power, and I do turn my will over to my higher power all the time. That's one of my favorite prayers, is the third step prayer. Do it every morning. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that people will, you know, that, yeah. I have to be on my knees with Jen to get that one right. So, anyway, continued working the steps, you know. My first inventory was done with my therapist at the time. And he was okay. You know, he was a believer in Al-Anon, but he wasn't a real practitioner. So I wasn't a real thorough inventory. But it got me to the point to really start to look at the things that I did in my life and how that mattered to me. And, you know, I was scared to death to do it. Fourth step just scared me to death. What am I going to find? You know, what are these defects that I supposedly have? You know, God, I didn't want to know. Turns out we all have them. You know, I have never seen anyone come out of an inventory with a list of defects that isn't this pretty much the same as mine. You know, we love an alcoholic too much. We're eternal optimists. We want things to get better. And yeah, it goes on and on and on. So I've been through the inventory process a number of times since. And all the what I've really learned is, you know, not how defective I am. It's taught me how similar I am to everyone else in this room. You know, I have the same human frailties that you have. I am here for the same reasons that you are. And that was an aha moment for me, truly. The rest of the steps, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Okay, that was good. I could do that with the exception of my now ex-wife, because about 4 years into my program, I ended up getting divorced from her. And not because she's an alcoholic, but her life went in directions that I was not willing to go. I don't know if you guys know this, but alcoholics, they like to lie, cheat, and steal. Can you believe it? Addicts do it too. And she was all over it. And I was learning in this program about honesty, about being accountable for my actions. She had none. It was just incompatible. You know, our lives were going to be totally incompatible. And it just finally dawned on me that it isn't going to work. So, ended up divorced, which was, you know, ultimately a very good thing, because, wow, I learned I learned how good life can be without those kinds of difficulties in my life. As a direct result of that, I got involved in a number of activities with Al-Anon members, one of which was softball, where I met Jen. And that's just been amazing. Jen has her own program. Our relationship is based on the principles of Al-Anon. And that has turned out to be fantastic. I don't think there's any difficulties our higher power could throw at us that we couldn't handle, because we've had them. Like I was talking about my daughter Candace, the addict. While she was using the heroin, she ended up getting pregnant. And my first grandchild, and you're using, are you, no, this can't, you can't. So I had to go to all my brothers, and by this time, and like I said, I had some program under my belt, so it was a damn good thing, as I was able to call people and say, what do I do? And they said, Jim, she's got her own higher power. Fuck, I knew you were gonna say that. But they were right, you know, and she came to me one day and she wanted to know, Dad, what do you think about this pregnancy? I went, I can't answer that. And, fortunately I had talked about it with my brothers ahead of time, so that when I sat down with her and I knew the question was coming, and when she asked me, I was able to tell her, Candace, I love you, and I hope this works out for the best for you. And that was all I said. And I'll tell you, I probably nearly bit the end of my tongue off, trying to not go there. All of the things that were swirling around my head, what the hell are you doing bringing a child into the world? This, and look at this guy. Oh, God. I don't even want to think about that. Fortunately, I don't. And again, I have learned here what to do. When my thinking goes woo, today I have prayer. I have step 11, prayer and meditation, which I practice every day. And it keeps me sane, because the addicts and alcoholics are still doing what they do, and they're going to keep doing what they do. And I am not going to change that. And, fortunately, after some time, I did get a higher power. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I was shocked. It's like, wow, this is awesome. And it was at one of the workshops, which I don't know if you guys know, Men's Committee over here in the Valley puts on workshops every 4 workshops a year, and I went to an 11-step workshop, and I just had this moment of clarity, this epiphany, and it was fantastic. And I went, wow, all right, I get it, okay, God, I get it now. This is your world, not mine. I want it to be certain ways, but it's not gonna be the way I want it to be. It's, I don't know what lessons you have for me, but whatever they are, I'll face them, using the tools of this program. So I think I'm out of time. Thanks.